So I'm speaking with Paola Harris, investigative reporter, photojournalist and author regarding the ET phenomena and its associated studies. Paola has been in the field of ET research since 1979, and from 1980 to 1986, she was an assistant to Dr. J. Allen Hynek of Project Blue Book, a major figurehead in ufology. In 1997, Paola met Colonel Corso, the man responsible for the famous The Day After Roswell book, for which Paola wrote the preface. She has networked with some of the biggest names in ufology, including Robert Dean, Travis Walton, Stephen Greer, Linda Moulton Howe, and many more. And she's a passionate researcher, writer, and teacher, and I'm very happy to have her on. Paola, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jay. I want to thank you so much for inviting me. I love talking to people internationally because I am international. Most of my work was done, including the Colonel Corso story in 1997, while I was based out of Rome, Italy, where I was teaching high school there and then doing the UFO work on the side. But I want to add that when I wrote the preface to The Day After Roswell, it was for the Italian book I think that General Trudeau wrote it. Strom Thurmond wrote it for the American book.
My mistake there.
Yeah, no, because I don't want people going,
Well, that's still a good thing. That's still a big deal.
Because it's not in Italian. We translated the book into Italian and had him come over to Italy twice. So we got most of the disclosure in Italy in those days. He died in 1998.
Could you tell me a little bit about Colonel Corso and like the whole Roswell scenario? How did you actually get involved with him in the first place?
Well, the thing is, at that time, I moved to Italy in 1992 because I was really interested in the European community joining all the countries, you know. So I got a job at the American Overseas School of Rome. And from there, I worked for a magazine called Area 51. Later, it becomes X Times because I still write for them. And my boss said, Paola, in 1997, we are going to send you to Roswell because there's a big party there. It's the 50th anniversary. So the 50th anniversary of Roswell, you know, Roswell happened around July 4th, 1947. You remember Independence Day. So I wasn't really happy about doing it. I wrote about it in my book called Connecting the Dots. I had a personal situation. I didn't want to go. But my boss made me go to interview someone I had never seen, a book I had never read, but was the biggest story in 1997. I think they even talked about it on Time magazine. So I came to America, and these people that I know from Boulder, Colorado, where I am right now, which was my hometown right now, picked me up, and we drove 6 hours. It was more like 8 hours, I think, to Roswell. But you must remember, I didn't have a place to stay, and the whole place was crowded because it was a big party. So I went to the media center there, and they said, you open up the phone book and good luck, because there's nothing here. So I opened up the phone book, and the first place I put my finger on was the Sally Port Inn. So I called them, and they had a room for 3 nights. And later I found out it was the room next to Colonel Philip Corso.
That is a major synchronicity right there.
Well, what does that tell you? I mean, you know, I had no place to stay. I didn't even know what the man looked like.
Yeah.
So I ended up at the UFO Museum, which is the biggest tourist attraction. He was giving a press conference. I was standing with a lot of other journalists who couldn't get close to him because Simon & Schuster, the publisher, would not let anybody get close to him. I was standing there and I thought, how in the world am I going to get an interview with that guy up there? Because he was on a panel. And so some blonde guy that was standing next to me said, you're from Italy. And I said, yes, because I had a press badge on. And he said, ask my father some questions in Italian. He was stationed there. And I said, who's your father? He said, Colonel Corso. And so I said, oh, my God, this is his son. I'm right next to him. I said, I'm embarrassed. I can't do it. So Colonel Corso's son takes his hand and shoves me into the crowd in front of the camera. So I have no choice. And I asked him about the Santilli footage. So, you know, the famous alien autopsy Santilli footage. And for you people that are listening to this interview, I hope you go to my YouTube, because I have all the original work on the Santilli footage done by my boss, Maurizio Baiata. And what the world did not see was the original footage, which he saw. There were two films. The second film came out as The Alien Autopsy. But if people want to know more about that, go to my YouTube channel, and my Patreon account has all of it. However, when I asked that question to Colonel Corso, Jay, what he said to me publicly was, you know, that seemed really authentic to me, he said, because I had those lenses that they peel off the body. See, for a long time, people thought that aliens had these big black eyes. And what those are light collecting lenses. But I had in front of me the man who worked at the Pentagon in the 1960s, Colonel Philip Corso, that actually had them as part of the artifacts. And he told me in front of everybody that they used to take these lenses and walk up and down the aisles of the Pentagon. They could see the furniture at night. So what does that tell
you?
Oh,
my gosh.
People that are arguing left, right, and every which way, I feel like telling them, do your homework and go to the people who worked at the Pentagon. Go to the people that worked on this. Don't go to internet. They don't know anything. And so when he said that, I thought, oh, my God, you know, he had those lenses. So yeah, that part, it could be partially true. And so he said to me, I see you're from Italy. I need to talk to you. But in my brain, I didn't know how I was going to do it, because all those people around him, and I didn't know what to do. So I just didn't know. I mean, the universe jumped in there, because I was coming out of my room and he was coming out of his store. So I said to him, here I am. Can I talk to you? And he said, I'm going to come in and talk to you. He said, tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the morning. I thought, oh my God, that's early. And he knocked on my door. He had two of his books signed for two of his Italian friends here, including Rapanelli, with whom he worked during World War II, that I had to give these books to the people in the military he worked with.
Right,
during World War II. And then he came and he sat down and he gave me an interview. Now, the interview that he started to give me, I never printed, because I couldn't do it. I wanted all the back engineering stuff of the 1960s. I wanted to know how he did it. Came to find out later, Jay, that he brought it to big major, you know, companies, which is the military industrial complex. And this is just the Army, remember, 1960. A lot of woodwork, all the Air Force guys come out and say, oh, yeah, well, we were doing it way before. Of course you were. Of course you were. Because it was the Army Air Force in 1945.
Right.
They changed to the Army and Air Force split in 1948. So if the Air Force had a crash, I mean, if they were there, they're not going to talk about it. The Army talked about it because they're bragging. I mean, they had Colonel Corso. So, and you know, I've worked on a case in 1945 in San Antonio, New Mexico, which is 2 years before Roswell.
Right.
And that was Army Air Force, too. So it would be Army, you know, who the Air Force then takes its stuff. The Army then takes its stuff. But anyway, so Corso gave me this interview, Jay, that, I mean, I don't know if people know about it. It was about contact with a being in White Sands. It's in all my books. It's, oh my God. I mean, go to my YouTube channel, my interview with Maurizio Baiata, where we talk about the Colonel. That's on my YouTube channel, but my Patreon channel has incredible interviews from all over the world even now. Okay, so Colonel Corso was the head of he was at a post in Fort Riley, Kansas. And in 1947, a cargo came through and was placed in the veterinary quarters that had an alien being in it. He picked up, and I don't know if there were others there. He just saw, he looked into one of the crates and saw a being with a large head that looked like a child in blue liquid. That is in all of his testimony. People could look at it. So, you know, we're not sure if that was the Roswell crash beings, because they say they took them by plane. But Colonel Corso said whatever was going across country didn't want to take a chance that it would be destroyed. So it was in a cargo. It was being taken by trucks. And he saw this and he said, I put it in the back of my mind. I didn't think about it anymore. He says, I saw it. I was witness to it. It was at Fort Riley, Kansas. It was in 1947. And then he tells me that in 1957, he is the head of a missile battalion at White Sands, New Mexico. And they are doing missile testing with nuclear warheads. And he sees, as he's flying over the desert, a UFO in the desert. And he says he lands his plane. It's on his territory, you know, that he's involved with. He's the head of this battalion. And you can look at his records. He's not lying. It says it. And all his military records. I printed them in my book, Conversations with Colonel Corso, because the American ufologists just bashed him. They just didn't take him seriously. And then there was a court case against the book, which silenced him immediately. So everything we got in Europe. We got the real truth. So anyway, when I was sitting next to him in Roswell, he said, 1957, I saw this craft personally. He drove up to it. It was appearing and disappearing in the desert. He threw some cactus under it, and it squashed the cactus, so it was physical and dimensional. And then he told me from the left-hand side of the of his vision, from a cave, came a being. It was a small man. It was not a gray. He had a helmet on, and he had around his head a silver band with a magenta or red stone in the middle, which Colonel Corso called an interface. Colonel Corso, being Italian, pulled out his gun. He pointed it at this being. Colonel Corso also had a knife in his boot. I mean, I saw about the knife. I saw the stiletto at his home. He's Sicilian. I mean, what do you want? Yeah. He was also the head of the intelligence community in Rome when he was 28 years old. This man was amazing.
Wow.
So he pulled out this in 1957 now, 10 years after Roswell, points out the gun at the being, and the being says, could you shut down your radar so I can leave? Because Colonel Corso knew they were instructed to shut down their radars during certain times of the day. The military knew that the radars were interfering with these vehicles, and they were crashing. They were coming down. And so the being said to Colonel Corso, would you shut down your radars? And Colonel Corso said, what do you have to offer me? I know about you people. And the being said, and this is used everywhere now, the being said, a new world if you can take it.
Yeah. I think the last time I heard that was on Stephen Greer's film.
It's on Stephen Greer's film. It's on Whitley Strieber used it extensively. He may have even used it in articles. The UFO community used it extensively.
It's a powerful statement.
A new world if you can take it. But then, the colonel is sitting there with Paula Harris, who only does nuts and bolts. She's been trained by Hynek, because Hynek is a scientist. He never talked about contact. He never talked about aliens. No. So I'm sitting there going, I don't want this interview. I don't want to hear this. I'm not going to print this, Colonel, because they're going to think you're crazy. They're going to think you're a crazy old man. And he really liked me as a person. So he wrote it on a napkin. He said, Paula, what does that mean, a new world if you can take it? Well, we're 20 years later and I can understand what it means. But, at the time, I have the napkin. He wrote it on a new world if you can take it. And I said, this isn't the interview I want. I can't print this. Can you talk to me about back engineering? So, that's insulting, but that's, I wasn't very good. What can you do? I wanted to put it in a way that people would be I wasn't touching contact then.
I think the social stigma of the time. I don't think the society would have really reacted as well as it may do now in regards to the consciousness contact aspect of it back then. So nuts and bolts might have been a better thing to cover, really.
Yeah, and then I couldn't fathom it either. I thought, what is he kidding?
Yeah.
You know, I've done work in Latin America now, and that's all it is contact. So I've changed my mind so many times. And the only kind of researchers I even want to talk to are those that change their mind. Those are the only ones I care about anymore, because this is so complex, Jay. This is so complicated. It's so different from anything that's out there that you have to be ready to keep an open mind. So what happened was I invited him to Italy after that, and he spoke twice there, including at San Marino. San Marino is an independent republic, much like Monaco, and the politics there enabled us to draft up a document to go to the United Nations. And that particular conference, who was there, was Colin Andrews and Michael Heseman and all the foreigners and goodness, just a lot of researchers, Yvonne Smith, I was there, and it was put together by Roberto Pinotti, and everybody signed the paper to bring this to the United Nations. That had been done in the 70s with Heinrich Jacques Vallée and Cooper, the astronaut, and Lee Spiegel to open it up under Grenada, which was, Sir Eric Gary that wanted it discussed. A small country has nothing to lose. They can make a resolution. They don't have an army that's going to, suffer. Nobody's going to suffer. In the case of Grenada, they had a coup which displaced Sir Eric Gary, so it never went anywhere, unfortunately. In San Marino, they changed politics, so it never went anywhere. However, Colonel Corso did sign that document. He believed in disclosure, and what he said to me, and if you go on the internet, you'll see it all over the place, is he said, the young people can handle it. People can handle it. Yeah. Please tell them the truth. Stop messing around with them. And then the thing for me, and then you can ask me other questions about this, as a journalist, that was when I realized why the secret was being kept secret, because it's about the fact that we have the technology, and the technology's gone into military industrial complex. It's about money. It isn't about aliens. It's not about any scary stuff. It's not about religion. It's not about it's about the fact that this technology that's been developed is making tons of money. And unfortunately, like Stephen Greer says, the technology was available in the 1950s to give us anti-gravity and everything. I mean, that's all true. I mean, I Stephen, what comes out of his mouth, he knows. He knows. I mean, he does his homework. He knows the people. He's talked to them. He's, what he says is true. So since you can't do anything about that, because that's money and that's economy and that's military industrial complex and that's cover up, the only thing that you can do is communicate directly with the beings.
Absolutely. That's been my goal throughout the entirety of creating Project Unity, really, is in my entire kind of introduction into this subject was a weird one. And it was more of a spiritual thing that didn't involve UFOs and ETs for me personally. And then suddenly I was kind of placed into this position where these things connected to what I previously learned about consciousness, because I was just someone who was trying to understand consciousness to some level at the age of, I think, 19 to 20. I was starting to become quite curious into, I wanted to know what life really was. I always thought quite deeply on things, and I was curious, and I started looking into quantum mechanics and consciousness and making some connections, and then the UFO subject kind of landed on me. And it was a really, again, it's a synchronicity. It's one of those, my best friend showed me Unacknowledged. And I hadn't really thought about UFOs before watching Unacknowledged, the documentary Stephen Greer did. Which is really strange because I believed in them, but I had never entertained them. So all the way through my life, I haven't been a UFO researcher. Literally, I'm 25 now, and in the past 2.5 years, I think this is where I've ended up in my life with realizing just how important this is. But I've had my own experiences through C5, and I've had many, and so that's been kind of the prime driver is the fact that although the nuts and bolts of this conversation, the insane level of illegal action that has been going on in the security apparatus of not just the United States government, but all over the world, I'm sure there's governments that are responsible in some shape or form for maintaining the secrecy at, you know, varying levels. But, you know, we can circumvent that apparatus of security quite literally in our own back gardens by just having a contact experience. And so, yeah, no, I just wanted to agree that it seems to be such a profound answer to how do we enact disclosure and how do we solve this issue is, well, if we teach people that this can be done just, you know, with a few people outside or even on your own, then we don't need them to disclose information.
Well, I loved hearing your story. Thank you for, I don't know you that well, so.
I know.
This is great that you did it this way. I was a consultant on Unacknowledged, as I was on Sirius, as I am on Q1, because I know everybody. I know the people, mostly military intelligence people, astronauts, and so forth. I know a lot of people, and I also have the same vision that Stephen does. And I have gone on so many C5s, my God, with him. He's amazing. And, you know, I admire you. I will tell you that the bottom line, you're already in graduate school, Jay, so I don't know what to tell you, because consciousness is the bottom line.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how to explain it to people, but a fish doesn't know it's swimming in water. And the water that the fish is in is consciousness. So everything moves through that water,
right,
including the craft, the beings. And there's not reptilians, greys, and Nordics, which is ridiculous stupidity on the part of the UFO community. I worked with Clifford Stone, who did crash retrieval. He had a manual, a first aid manual, that had information for 57 different types of beings. And we shove them into greys, reptilians, and Nordics.
Yeah.
And so here's Clifford Stone in Vietnam doing three different crash retrievals in the 70s. And he's meeting beings that look very much amphibian. And they're people. They're people. They're not abducting anybody. They're just there watching the Vietnam War. And I'm thinking, are any of you people doing any research? Have you read Clifford Stone's books? Do you ever read his Disclosure Project disclosure when he let a being go that was sitting at the Pentagon in a room, you know? And I had asked him about that. I said, you talk about this when you did Stephen Greer's disclosure and you start to cry. And he goes, yeah. He said, because the being said to me, he said telepathically, they had me in the room with them because, you know, Clifford, when he was young, had contact, so he had telepathic abilities. That's why he was in the Army. Here we go again, the Army at 16. The being said that he was afraid, but he wasn't afraid for himself. He was afraid his own were going to come and get him and kill everybody that was in that room. So Clifford let him go. He got wire cutters and let him go through the fence. These are real events. I mean, people have the very wrong idea about our visitors. The American scene is mainly abduction, which I think is ridiculous because there, you know, it's in the early days, and that's why I do most of my work out of Latin America now. Spacemen were walking off spaceships, and they were talking to people. The whole Orthon Adamski thing. Read a book called We Are Here, Visitors Without Passports by Michel Zerger, Z-I-R-G-E-R, who's French, and did all of the background work on that, what happened in 1953 at Desert Center. I mean, originally these people were coming here saying, don't use nuclear, you're one of us, we're all over the place, whether they happen to be interdimensional or interplanetary, they're concerned. And then we get Betty and Barney Hill in the 60s, and the whole thing turns into little gray aliens.
Yeah.
And forget about everything else. And it's really difficult because Stephen is criticized for that. But I had to go back and do the 1950s research. It's on my YouTube. I interviewed people that from the 1950s that saw physical spacemen. Then I went down to Peru, Jay, and I talked to Sisto Paz, Ricardo Gonzalez, Luis Fernando, and Enrique Villanueva. And those guys are seeing physical space people too in the 1970s. I don't blame for the space people going down to Latin America because nobody cares about the craft down there. They're not going to shoot them and everything. So they have to go to people that are going to get the message. And obviously nobody here is getting any messages. So everybody's all stuck on the no contactee abduction thing.
Yeah.
Which I'm not saying didn't happen because I knew John Mack very well. And you can have that. But Colonel Corso personally told me that when he saw the autopsy of the beings of the Roswell crash, and he saw many autopsies, they were clones. They did not think for themselves. They were little machines that were able to drive the craft with their brain. You know, they became one with the craft.
Yeah.
They were like little robots. They were little clones. So we made a whole mythology around these little clones and don't realize that there's a lot of all kinds of different kinds. 57, you know, beings hanging out, and for different reasons, they come and talk to you.
And have you had experiences throughout childhood? Are you one of those? Because many people I speak to have always had experiences all the way through childhood. I wasn't one of those. Did you have experiences?
No, I wasn't
early
one
on?
Of those. No, what happened to me, and I'm glad you asked me this question, because I've learned a lot. I was teaching school in 1977, and I was given the class science fiction. I have a master's degree in English. And at that time, I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I think it was 1978. At the very end, I began to cry for no reason at all. I didn't even think about UFOs. And I was in my 30s. I'm now 75. So I was going, what's happening to me? And I realized, and I only realized now after reading the books of Jacques Vallée, who's brilliant. May everybody read his Forbidden Science 1,
yes.
2, 3, and 4. My God, those are disclosure books a la Max.
Yes.
Yeah, a la Max. They're the maximum disclosure books, and they're diaries. So he's very, very human in those books. And I didn't read them until 2 years ago, and I began to understand that what I was crying about was the personage of Jacques Vallée there, when he meets with the beings and they give the hand signals and they give a smile. So I'm going, okay, why am I emotional? And then they give me the class science fiction, and then I wanted to see if it was real. So there was a wedding in Evanston, Illinois. So I went to that wedding, and then I said, here's where Alan Hynek's Center for UFO Studies is. I'm going to go in there. He's never going to be there in a million years, but I want to see the files myself. And so there's Alan Hynek standing right in front of me.
My
with
his gosh.
Ah, Jay, you think I did this? I didn't do this. And Alan says to me, you speak Italian? And I said, yeah, I do. And he goes, I want you to be my assistant on all the Italian cases. I'm going to send you all the cases. And I worked with him for 6 years, from 80 to 86 until he died, became a personal friend of his, became a very personal friend of his family. So I'm very close to Paul Hynek right now. He was a little kid when I was there. And Paul Hynek, who is now the producer of Project Blue Book, it's like we're family.
That is amazing.
And I've met Jacques Vallée. So, I'm going, oh, my God, like that movie. Oh, it was like, here's how many years later, 1980s to, now is like 40 years later. 40 years later, I'm beginning to understand all the stuff that was happening to me. I'm thinking, but you know, I'm a good journalist. I'm very nuts and bolts. I'm very stable. I can tell who's lying and who's not lying. I also know ridiculousness when I see it. So what I did, Jay, was I created a conference. I've been doing it for 7 years now, and I will comp you a ticket if you want to come. Nevada, called Starworks USA. And it's a 3-day conference with international speakers and panels and only serious discussion, even though we have fun. And year I'm bringing James Fox, who's a good friend of mine, to show the phenomena. And I'm bringing Alan Stevelman from Argentina to talk about Witness to Another World. They both have Jacques Vallée in them. But they're great movies. And, you know, I have 18 speakers. I have great movies. We have a great cocktail party. We have a gala dinner. And it is November 4 through 6, 2020. And we're going to do it because by that time, I'm sure everything's going to be fine. We're also going to live stream it. We're going to live stream. It's on artificial intelligence. And I do it because of a theme. I have a theme. Last year was remote viewing, and we had Uri Geller and Russell Targ. Nice. And this year, we're having, I've already got the robots. I've got them behind me. Wait, I live with these guys.
Wow.
4-foot robot right there. And he talks, he does kung fu, he tells jokes. And I decided to do that, Jay, because I can't take the circus atmosphere of American ufology sometimes when I've attended conferences. And I need to make it serious. And I really, you know, have international people come. I have to. I have Vitaly Sakharov from England this year. But going back to consciousness, the researcher that does the most on that is Grant Cameron. And you know him, right?
Yeah, we've spoken a few times now.
Well, he graduated. I don't know how to say it. It's like you go to school and you go to graduate school. And it took me a long time. And to understand that it's all connected in consciousness. And what consciousness merely means to the outside person is just that you're awake and aware that you don't live in a physical 3D world.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said before, it's been literally the one thing that has clicked into place more profoundly than really anything else, because of the fact, I think, that it puts you in a position of such, like, it's a self-realization path. You know, I've said this to people, that CE5 and the practicing of contact modalities that include consciousness, it's more than anything a path to getting to know yourself first before you then start knowing other beings, because it's about self-realization. It's about realizing your own ability. It's not about reaching out and asking these beings to show you how to do this type of contact. It's about some form of a self-realization within you, that you are actually more than just your body, that your consciousness extends to just, you know, more than just this physical frame.
Well, this is everybody.
Sorry, I just got a call then. I'm just canceling it off.
No, I mean, you say you're 25 years old?
Yes.
Oh my God.
I had a very quick wake-up call.
Alan Hynek and Jacques Vallée and Colin Andrews, who wrote The Edge of Reality. All these guys that have studied this for all these years have come to this conclusion, and you're only 25 years old?
Yes, ma'am.
That's not normal.
Well, I've had some pretty interesting things happen to me, and I suppose it's just resulted in a kind of cumulative effect that's, you know, happened quite quickly. But essentially, what, you know, to kind of give you a little bit more, because I know you don't know me very well, more of a backstory on why I'm even, you know, here having this conversation with you, let alone making Project Unity or anything like that, was when I was about 19 or 20, I'd moved out of my house when I was 18, and I was off it, going off to university in London. And I think by the age of 19, 19 and a half, for, you know, various reasons, including the stress of university, I ended up having quite a heavy depression, and I was, you know, feeling very low. And I was, you know, at that point, I didn't have any sort of background or any sort of foundation in consciousness or faith or God or anything like that. So I didn't have much of an idea of what I am. And, you know, not many people do at the age of 19. So, you know, I was just stumbling around trying to figure myself out. And essentially, I had a bit of a big depression. I got given these books by my dad, and it's by an author called Neil Donald Walsh. And it's a series of books called Conversations with God. Are you familiar with them at all?
Well, I think I've heard about them.
Yeah, they're pretty famous books now. I think they've been translated into like dozens of languages. But at the time he gave them to me, I was very pessimistic. I just was kind of like, oh, these are just self-help books. I don't want to read them. I don't feel like this is going to help. And anyway, I did end up reading those books. They profoundly changed my mindset on what God was, because before that, I grew up with a Christian family, but it wasn't like a strict Christian family. We didn't have to go to church every Sunday or anything like that. But, you know, my parents were Christians. And so I kind of grew up with the idea of thinking about God as a man in the sky with clouds and the angels and the harps. And it never made sense to me. And it used to just annoy me that people thought that way. And so I just didn't have that idea of God in my head. These books were the first thing to kind of spark that idea that God is actually just universal awareness being presented in all these different forms, including yourself, and that the awareness within yourself is the awareness of the universe and all this. And it made a lot of sense, and it was answering a lot of questions. So I went from that point, and it profoundly changed my life in my outlook and took me out of a depression. And I started looking into more things. I started looking into consciousness and quantum mechanics, and like these two ideas I believed were somehow very connected, and this idea of almost like a symbiosis between spirituality and science through this kind of idea of understanding consciousness and understanding quantum mechanics and them marrying together in a way. And I just had this feeling that that was going to be a very profound thing that would change the world. And then my friend showed me Unacknowledged, and it just kind of clicked in with the UFO propulsion, the quantum vacuum engineering, the fact that it's, you know, a conversation of advanced physics that break our current paradigm, which is what I was thinking would be the case anyway. And I wasn't thinking about UFOs at that point. And it connected in the consciousness aspect, because it brought in CE5 and was saying, not only, you know, are you this universal consciousness awareness within a physical body, but that on its own can allow you to make contact. And I just never thought about that before then. I'd had the idea, I kind of grounded myself in this state that, oh, okay, I'm in a physical body having a physical experience, but I'm definitely not just this physical experience. And I'd come to that conclusion, but I'd never thought about the idea of contacting anything. And the weird thing about it was, I'd actually, to try and cut a very long story short, you know, I'd read these books, had these changes, and had these realizations. And before I watched Unacknowledged, I actually slipped into another little depression, because I felt like I'd learned a lot, but I didn't know how to physically apply it. I didn't know how to actually do things with the knowledge that I had. And, you know, like understanding that I'm more than my body. Okay, well, I understand that, but what can I do with this? And I actually remember sitting in bed and having my own, I guess, version of a prayer, which was just talking out loud to the space around me. And, you know, just kind of like, I need something that basically allows me to do something in this physical world with the things I've learned, with the knowledge I've learned, with these ideas, and I have no idea what to do. Then my friend shows me Unacknowledged, and then the CE5 gets mentioned and it clicks in. And within 2 weeks, I'd had my own experience. And since then, I've had more than I can honestly count. But I've had four very major experiences for myself, which have really, you know, kind of changed my life and have been one of the huge reasons behind Project Unity. But yeah, consciousness is the key.
When did you start Project Unity?
I want to say just over a year and a half ago.
Okay, so you've been around for a while.
Yeah, like a little bit. I started the channel, and it was just, I wasn't sure where I was going with it. You know, I was just kind of uploading relevant CE5 footage from eSETI and CSETI and all these other different organizations, because that was what I was really amazed by at that time, was all of these different people capturing night vision footage. So a lot of it was, there wasn't like an actual plan for the channel at that point, but as it started growing, I've been lucky enough to connect with a lot of people, including you know, Richard Dolan and Grant Cameron and a few other people. And there's some stuff happening right now, which is hopefully going to be able to come out in the near future, which is really exciting. So I've got lots happening.
I want to encourage you not to get into the conspiracy theory stuff. I think that really lowers the vibration a lot. I know a lot. I'm friends with Paul Hellyer, the former defense minister. I was very good friends with Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14. I've done so much work with NASA astronauts. I mean, I'm not going to even go into it, but I realized that if people love sensationalism and you start feeding them that, then they don't think about their relationship to all of this.
Right. And
you know, they love, it's entertainment. It becomes entertainment. Tell me the latest dirty story, scandal. And then they lose the fact that if they're interested in this, they must have a reason. And you asked me, and I told you, as a child, I had no contact. But when I started doing the Latin American stuff, especially with Ricardo Gonzalez, and I want people, if they can, to read the book, A Contact from Planet Apu, I was dragged into a face-to-face meeting with a being whose ultimate message to me was, if you will lead, we will match your efforts because we're really in trouble here. And Grant knows it because Grant followed me with the camera to where it happened. And I was not alone. I was with five other people who saw the same guy standing there. And he communicated mainly with me. And I realized this was not like, I'm not running around saying, well, I had contact. I'm special.
Yeah.
When you have anything, you have a responsibility.
Yeah.
And because they're not on vacation, just trying to make you special. So as a journalist, I said, oh my God, what do I do now? And then I, as a writer, journalist, I had to start traveling in Latin America. I spent 2 weeks in Peru and on the story with Ricardo. And then I was in the Atacama Desert with a mass meditation, 300 people.
Wow.
It was so hard. I froze to death in a tent. People were fasting. There were some people taken to the hospital because at night it was like 30 degrees and the day was 110.
Wow.
And they couldn't stand the heat. So I lived through that. And sure enough, on the time and minute that Ricardo said we would have a sighting, it's on camera, the craft came right over our heads. And we knew there was no flight path because this is in the middle of nowhere in Chile. The Atacama Desert is in Chile. So I went through all of that physically, you know, like there was no bathrooms. I mean, I can't even tell you if I need you. You know, when they're telling me that they're going to be somewhere and there's a message and you better be there. And there's meditation and not yelling, come and take me. Have a party. But there's heavy meditation going on for like 2 hours before the actual sighting. You know, that is the kind of thing I want to be part of because I know it's real. It's not in the United States, it's somewhere else. And I know who is in that ship because those people are the ones that communicate with Ricardo. Besides, I saw one of them.
What did they look like?
A tall, he's beautiful. He was tall. He wasn't beautiful to me because I was scared to death and I started trying I started having PTSD. I mean, they had to actually hold me down because I was so freaked out. He was tall, 10 foot tall. He had on an exercise, a bicycle suit, you know, those really, tight bicycle suits.
Yeah.
He had a long face, blonde, but not blonde, more white hair. Almond shaped eyes that were brown, not blue. He's not a Nordic. He was not a Nordic. And but he was a Nordic if you want to categorize him like that. These people are in the book Contact from Planet Apu. And what happened is I don't want to go because I don't like camping. I don't like freezing to death. I don't like fasting. And I didn't believe it. But I was dragged there, kind of. You know, they said, come because your name has been mentioned. So I went. This was in Mount Shasta in 2014 at midnight. So I freaked myself out because I had to do some walking in the dark. We couldn't use flashlights. And then I had to stand in a certain spot, which, you know, people have said it's a portal. But I mean, it's not there for everybody to stand in. It was created. And so I'm looking at this person and I realize that that I have no frame of reference. So
yeah.
I terrorized. Yeah. Because everything 10 foot, you know, so you came up to his like waist.
Yeah, that's intense. So,
I had to change every, I really suffered post-traumatic stress, not because it wasn't a wonderful experience. It's because I had to change my mind again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you understand? It's as long as you don't know, you're walking around and say, oh yeah, that might be nice. But then when you know, then what happened after that was that the message came. If you will lead, we will match your efforts, which means get off your butt, go do something, because we're not here to vacation.
Yeah.
So I've been working really hard since 2014. That's one of the reasons I do the conference. They want specific information and they want people to take responsibility for this planet. Because the planet is, I mean, apart from the virus, yeah, people can tell because of the virus. The skies cleared up. The ozone layer got fixed. You can see all of Los Angeles. People in India could see all the Himalayas for the first time. I mean, what? You have to be like a rocket scientist to know that.
Oh, no.
That we are ruining everything, and it takes a virus to keep us home to show us what the planet is like. You're like, it's... It made me laugh, as because, you know, it's so obvious, and what people need to do, and not everybody can do that, is reevaluate their values in life.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think that coronavirus, you know, it's one of those where obviously at the moment we're in the midst of it and it's hard to see whereabouts we're going to land. But do you feel that it could potentially be some form of a catalyst to change people's minds? Could it push things forward in terms of maybe wanting a better world now that we've seen something change from it?
Well, personally, on a journalistic level, I'm worried about biological warfare. However, it was either that or another war. So what would you rather have? Thing is, the only time people ever change anything is during tragedy. So it's either that, another war, a meteor that hits the earth or something, in order to change the course of events. And people keep, you know, mentioning it at 9/11. Oh, it hasn't been as bad since 9/11. We got to stop that. I don't want any more viruses and I don't want any more 9/11s. So can we just change without having to go through all this stuff and all these people dying?
What would you say is the most important aspects of things for people to focus on? Like, maybe not even just in regards to the UFO subject, but if you look, if you're wanting to enact and push forward some form of positive change, what do you personally see as the most viable options to create something else, something new?
Well, you know, I love the Dalai Lama. I mean, you know, he's so cool. He is so cool.
He is. I saw him once with Russell Brand at Manchester. It was amazing listening to him talk. But yeah, go on. Please go on.
Yeah, he's the wisest guy on earth because he's laughing his head off and he's very wise. He doesn't take everything so seriously. Compassion, caring for your brother, knowing that you could be in their shoes, being kind to people. Knowing money isn't everything, you can't take it with you. Giving. I mean, this sounds like Christian values, and they are.
It's just the basics, isn't it, really?
It's what Christ said in the beginning before a structure was, you know, before a whole structure was created. And this is what a lot of the great masters say. I am not a particular religion. I'm more spiritual than religious, but I love the Buddhist tradition. I love the meditation idea. Yeah, and you know, I think you just said it. I think you're the bravest. You're the one. Look, we have you. You're doing it. You know, you take the opportunity to sit down during the coronavirus and figure out what's going on in your life, and figure out how you want to see the world. Because we could do a reset.
Yeah.
You know, we could do a reset. Like when we can start doing things. I mean, we're still stuck here in Colorado. We can't. There's no restaurants open. You can't go to malls or anything. We're still in the house. Everybody has to wear a mask.
Yeah. But
if and when things start up, don't do the same old, same old.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's it. And, you know, I always say this because at least on self-reflection, you know, on my own personal life, and I think many people can agree with this, is that if there's a moment in your life where you needed to change, like on self-reflection of looking back on moments where you were someone that you maybe weren't serving your best interests and you needed to change, this always requires a turbulent scenario, like a turbulent situation. And you might not even always understand that situation when you're going through it. It can just seem like a negative time. It can just seem like a bad event. And sometimes it can require, you know, a year later of self-reflection to go, oh, this led to here, and, you know, A led to B, led to C, and that's why I'm who I am now. And so I would say that, you know, on the microcosm, that works just as much as it does on the macro. And so with a planetary consciousness, when the collective consciousness needs to shift in some way and it needs to be kicked into, you know, into working in a different way, then it's going to require some pretty significant catalysts. It's going to require some global issues. So just as you can see in your own personal life how the trials and tribulations actually are part of life and work as a teaching form, then you can see the same thing happening on a global scale. And maybe this can be something that allows us to wake up a little bit further enough to push it into a form of real change. Because I think so many people are fed up of saying the same things. We all know politicians are corrupt. We all know the system's corrupt. We all know it's all corrupt. And yet we just say it and not enough happens. So I think that I said this recently and it got a couple of likes on Twitter. I think that it was a good statement. It was just that we more than researchers now need informed revolutionaries.
Well, and can I give you a piece of advice? Because I think you're going to do a lot of really incredible things. In the UFO community, what we have is a lot of people play a lot of games in the arena of conspiracy theory, and they think they have the answer and they're going to out people and stuff like that. That doesn't change anything. That entertains. I think what your job is, and you just said it, is to inspire. That's why I do the Laughlin Conference, is to inspire. Yeah. Everybody comes out and they're inspired to go do something. It isn't just let's go and be entertained and find out the latest garbage on what was done and all the scandals and politics and everything. I'm aware of those. I actually know a lot, but that has not going to change. That is never going to change the order. The order is going to be inspiration. All the great people, the Gandhis of the world, the people that inspired, the courageous ones that went ahead and said, guess what? We can invent something different. Here's what we can do. These are suggestions. And you said you got a lot of likes when you made that statement, because what you did is you gave them something to think about and be inspired by. And I don't know if you keep a notebook or a journal, but I think you should do that.
Well, I don't actually, but I've been told that I should be. You're not the first person to say that, so I might start.
Well,
I've been told I should write
a
book.
I mean, because then you forget the wonderful things you said, and they're like steps. They're stepping stones to you know, like the people that find out these things, they're doing journals, they do diaries, they do books.
Yeah.
And people read them and it changes. You just said books changed your life.
Absolutely.
So if you forget and then you go into a small depression, you could go back to the journal and remember. It's very important, I think, that we inspire people. So when I find an inspirational person, a saying, one of the ones I put up all the time is Ray Bradbury. I love Ray Bradbury. I love Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, I love anything having to do with the vision of the future. I'm reading a book right now called Last Conversation about Gene Roddenberry's last days. And he was amazing. He saw unity. He saw humanity as a baby race that could really, you know, inspire the planet, you know. Ricardo Gonzalez once told me, he says, Paula, he said, we're inspiring the universe. You don't understand. We're not being inspired by the ETs. The ETs are inspired by us, that we can actually do this,
yeah,
that we can actually rise above our nature. So, you know, may I encourage you to get a journal or notes or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll take you up on that.
Yeah, because that's the only way you're going to remember anything during this, and stay away from all the negative, you know, stuff out there, because it's there and we're aware of it,
mm-hmm,
but it doesn't change your personal life. And like you said, this is about you.
Yeah.
In the end, it's about you. It's about who we are. Robert Dean, whom I love dearly, my God, Sergeant Robert Dean. I love that man. I used to come to Italy and he used to say, this is not about them. This is about us, who we are, and what our possibilities are. You know, he used to say that. And I used to say, God, you got it. It's so brilliant. Why can't I say that? I remember what you just said.
I've got a video of his. I can't remember which one it is, but it is amazing hearing him describe how he feels about the phenomenon and what it represents. And I remember just watching it and having this big beaming smile on my face, nodding, going, yes, like that's definitely how it should be seen. It's brilliant. I loved it.
But he was a military man who graduated.
Exactly.
Again. He was a military man. He was in charge of NATO shape during the 60s when we had the wall, the Berlin Wall. And it was darn serious then. He could look at it as a matter of national security because the Russians thought it was our stuff and we thought it was their stuff and we could have pressed a button at any minute. And that's darn serious. You know, we could have started a war over this. But Robert, and he was a personal friend. He stayed at my apartment in Rome, I don't know, about 5 or 6 times. I would see him all the time. I mean, I accompanied him places. So we're talking about long conversations. Long conversations not only on the meaning and the philosophy of UFOs and contact, but the fact that whatever's out there has been here forever. It's been here for a long time. It didn't just appear at Roswell.
Right.
It's been here as part of our evolutionary evolution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the conversations we used to have were like really great because they were historical. And I miss the man. I mean, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about him and Colonel Corso and Alan Hynek and all the great ones and Jacques Vallée, who really has it. He's got the bottom line there. He's the most brilliant of everybody and the most criticized because he shoves in the psychic component and the paranormal component, which
is the part that I agree with the most, though. That's the part that I end up agreeing with, you know?
Yeah, well, I didn't know very much about him until 2 years ago. I mean, I knew he was in Close Encounters. I knew... You know, I knew, but I didn't, when I started reading The Invisible College and Forbidden Science, all four books, which are the greatest disclosure books ever, I began to realize that he had seen the paranormal aspect. In fact, he actually told Alan Hynek that there was paranormal in this. And Alan Hynek, who's an astronomer, and I used to walk down the street with Alan in New Mexico, and he used to say, Paula, don't ever mistake Venus for a UFO. So I knew he was nuts and bolts, person. And then he has this wonderful man, Jacques Vallée, who's saying, no, it ain't that simple. There is a paranormal dimensional component here that's trying to teach us something. It is a control system that is here, not by accident, but is trying to teach us something. So when I'm reading this, at all the coincidences in my life, all of them, the synchronicities, because I think that ET speak through synchronicities. I mean, if after I had that thing happen with Antarel, you know, I had my phone doing Morse code, I had messages, I had all kinds of weirdness in the house. I mean, I couldn't even deal with that. So I ended up buying a piece of land in Crestone, Colorado, where I bring Ricardo once a year in September and we do meditations like CE5s there on these 5 acres in Crestone. So it led me to do what you're doing with E5 stuff. Even though I'm not good at it, I bring, you know, people who are tuned in.
Well, it's for me, like the CE5, it was the deal breaker, because, you know, knowing about the information, you know, via military personnel or declassified documents or photos or videos was one thing. And to be fair, once I'd seen enough, I was pretty convinced. Didn't take too long for me to realize that there was a lot to find out about in the UFO, you know, subject. And I would never claim to be an extensive researcher. There's so many things I don't know. But, you know, that's the beauty of it, because I'm being able to talk to people and learn a lot more. But the consciousness aspect of it, it's, I don't know, it seems to me unavoidable. And also it seems to me that if you are in the UFO subject enough for a long enough time, you will eventually run into it. It will come to the point where you start looking at the strange conscious connection that there seems to be between these things. And I would also just like to say that when it comes to making CE5 contact as well, I think that for me, it was once I actually had a successful contact scenario, I couldn't not tell people. The thing is for me now is it's actually quite difficult for me to sometimes describe to people like why I'm doing Project Unity. I literally couldn't live with myself if I wasn't doing what I'm doing right now, because if I had the experiences I had and then just tried to go living my life and finding a job somewhere and just didn't really, you know, talk to people, I would hate myself. I would just feel like it was a betrayal of, because people need to know. And so, yeah, if for me, and I've spoken to a few people who feel the same, it's almost like there's an activation, you know, it's almost beyond your own control. There's just this element of, I don't know, almost automation on this now for me. I can't not do this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it was what I said before. I think one of the reasons why I even had what I had in Shasta was because they knew they grabbed a live one. They knew that I would not make it about me and contactee and this and that and, you know, invite me to talk. I never talk about it, actually.
Yeah.
That's so private what happened to me that I rarely talk about it. They knew that if they got to me, that I would do something.
Mm.
And they're not here on vacation. Jay, this is not a fun thing for them. This is not something they want to do because they got nothing better to do. They are concerned. They want us to grow up. Our society as it is an infantile society. It has not really evolved to any kind of wisdom, let alone any kind of, you know, we can't go out in outer space. We can't go see them or meet them or anything because we're so stuck in an economy that was a war reconstruction economy that we never put the money into. I mean, they are now, but Adamski's message in the 1950s was there are cycles in life where you can change your economy. You can make just as much money, you know, sending rockets into outer space and doing exploration a la Star Trek, as you can by killing people, creating enemies and terrorists. And then what happens is, and that's the conspiracy part that's all true, is we have to spend money there. So nobody gets off the planet, which is such a ridiculous, stupid thinking that we need some enlightened people. Yeah, let's all get off the planet. It would be nice. Put money into that. Let's go and let's not go to conquer the world and put an American flag there. Let's go to off world and put the species, the human species flag of all of us, of all the species. And it takes the coronavirus to realize we're all human species and we can all get the coronavirus. You know, it's not just one country that gets it. So I remember, you know, Edgar Mitchell's got a great quote, which I'm going to send you. I want you to use it if you can, because I mentioned about inspiring people. He said he told me about this, when he was in outer space, he looked back at the planet and he felt like grabbing some politician by the collar and saying, you see any borders there?
Yeah.
You see, why would we be killing ourselves over borders that are non-visible from space?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's this beautiful quote he had. I'm going to send it to you.
Yeah, please.
because God bless him, I love the man. He tried. He tried to with Noetic Sciences and sponsoring the SRI psychic research of the 70s, tried to do that the best he could to show people. And he was an engineer. I mean, we're talking about a scientist type person who, because he had an epiphany in outer space, he's Apollo 14. The epiphany was that he looked out at all the stars and he felt one with the universe. Yeah. That was the epiphany. It isn't that he saw aliens.
No.
But that was enough to change him and to change everything in his life. So I love that quote. I'll send it to you. And unless you have other questions to ask me, I want to thank you for, inviting me to be part of your world. I can't believe you're 25.
Well, look, I'm sure we'll catch up another time and maybe have another discussion further down the line, but yeah, we can end it here. It's been a fantastic conversation, and thank you for your compliments as well. So I really appreciate, you being as kind as you have been and telling me that I'm on the right path with what I'm up to. So that's big stuff coming from you, Paola.
Well, thank you, Jay, but we talked about such heavy stuff here and such so many important principles and values that we don't want to overload everybody. They'll all have a headache.
So yeah, absolutely.
We got to just talk a little bit at a time. Otherwise, all the poor people will go, oh my God, that was so heavy.
Well, I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm glad you have. And I'm going to send you the quote in homage to Dr. Edgar Mitchell.